Our Tax Act makes it harder for small business and businesses in Australia to compete with offshore companies because they don't have to pay the same amount of tax as what onshore companies here in Australia do.
Today, we are joined by Senator Gerard Rennick from Queensland.
600,000 immigrants. That is going to put a lot of pressure on carbon emissions, household rents, and of course, the cost of living.
Immigration has been said that's what's propping this real estate market. So what are some of the things that you would do to try and fix it without crashing it?
The things would be obviously lower immigration and fixed capital controls. But then what we need to do is to actually be able to...
One of the most frustrating taxes is, you know, they hit $1 million payroll.
Yep.
And now they get payroll tax. So
yep.
They're actually disincentivized to create jobs.
Payroll tax is a stupid tax. 75% of those renewables are owned by foreign companies, right? What we did with our energy system, which most of you can understand, back in 1985, we sold out and we're letting other countries exploit us like we're an active third world country. And we've got to stop that.
What's up, guys? Welcome to this very special episode of Unemployable. Today, we are joined by Senator Gerard Rennick from Queensland. This is an absolute cracker. We covered some of the biggest issues that are on the minds of Australians today, from immigration to house prices to the fact that we're selling off our foreign assets, we are giving away our children's future, and so much more. This is one juicy interview. Please like, comment, subscribe, and share this information with fellow Australians. Every Australian needs to hear this interview. We need to get far more active in this country. It is time to stop letting our good nature and our she'll be right, mate attitude persist. It is time to actually stand up and fight and vote and get the country that we deserve back. With that said, I hope you enjoy it. We certainly did. Bye for now. What's up, everybody? Welcome to this very special episode of Unemployable. Today, we have a very special guest here in the studio with us, none other than Senator Gerard Rennick. Now, before we get into this, guys, and before you savage us in the comments, yes, we will have Albo or Dutton on here if they choose to accept their invitations. But for now, we are really enjoying putting a spotlight on these voices in the Australian political landscape that get less of the spotlight. And we know you guys are enjoying it as well. This is going to be an absolute ripper of a podcast. And I just want to encourage you, if you don't know the policies or you like what you hear on the pod, go over to unemployable.com.au/Rennick, which is R-E-N-N-I-C-K, as in Gerard Rennick. And we have prepared for you there a free 25-minute summary in podcast format of all 26 policies that the People First Party have, so that you can just sit there and listen to it. And we encourage you to do this as we lead into the election. Get educated, learn the policy so that you make your vote count. With that said, welcome to the studio. Gerard, how are you?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Adam. Thanks for having me here.
Mate, we are stoked to have you. And, you know, we've been going through your content online and there's so much to talk about. But I think what would be a really good place to start is just like give the listeners a bit of background as to who you are, like where you grew up, how you grew up, and what your background is prior to politics.
Yeah, cheers. Thanks, Adam. I grew up in Chinchilla, born there in 1970, the son of a farmer and a midwife at Chinchilla Hospital. I went to school up until 15 out of Chinchilla, then went away to boarding school for the last 2 years in Toowoomba. Moved to Brisbane to get a Bachelor of Commerce, then graduated, went back to Dalby in Chinchilla for 3 years where I worked in small business, biz services in a tax accountancy firm. Then went overseas for what I thought would be about 2 years, but ended up being 7 years. So I had 6 months backpacking through Africa to get to London, 2 years based out of London. Then I got a job based out of Amsterdam for another, not quite three years, where I had about 8 months in the States, 8 months in Brazil, 8 months in Norway, 8 months in Amsterdam, and then 6 months in a few other countries just doing finance work. So, you know, lodging financial statements, buying companies, installing software, things like that. Then I quit that, went backpacking for about 20 months after that. So long story short, I went down to Turkey for Anzac Day, then flew across to Pakistan, did the roof of the world, the Karakoram Highway across to Beijing, caught the Trans-Siberian back to Moscow and St. Petersburg. Then legged down Eastern Europe, back through Turkey into the Middle East, so Syria, Jordan, Israel, across into Egypt, dived there for a couple of weeks off where I just dived in the Red Sea for a couple of weeks. Then flew across to Spain and Portugal, back down into Morocco, then Mali and Senegal. Came back up to Spain, flew across to the States, did the Eastern States, flew down to South America, did another loop around there for Carnival and caught up with a few friends I had there from Brazil. Then flew back to London, where I had a couple of months in London waiting for all the Starn visas. So then I came home via, flew across to Moscow, went back down through Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, into Iran, went back up through Pakistan, India, then over to Nepal, where I did the Annapurna circuit, flew back down to Southeast Asia, where I surfed in Nias for almost a month, then legged it around Southeast Asia, so Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand, and then came home. So I finished that. That was my 7 years overseas. Lived in Brisbane for 6 years, where I worked at Bank of Queensland. So I was a treasury accountant there, management accountant there, and managed the banking operations from the accounting side of things at the Bank of Queensland. Then got married, moved to Sydney, where I worked for Westfield for almost 7 years in tax and treasury. And in that time, I got a Master's of Tax Law down at Sydney, and I finished my Master's of Finance as well. And then moved back home in my early 40s after we had our first son in Sydney. And then I had a couple of contracting roles here in Brisbane. Then decided to basically stay at home for a few years and help raise my children because I felt, you know, you want to be there. My mum passed away, so I thought I want to be there for my children while they're young. And while I did that, I thought I'll have a crack at politics. And so I effectively got nominated for the third position on the Senate ticket about 6 years ago. And luckily enough, got into Parliament and I've been a senator since then.
So all of that is to say you have seen outside of Canberra. You have had a job other than a politician. And interestingly, because I did watch some of your long form content online and I couldn't help but think, what's this dude's background? Like, he's got a real business finance mind, which is really comforting given the world that we are living in today. So you're actually qualified to speak on financial matters as well, which is really awesome. So the move into politics, like, what was driving you? Like, I've seen your content. You're one guy that will stand up at inquiries and you will actually push and fight and you will push them on points. And I get a sense that there's a real reason you're in this job. Why did you go into politics? What are you passionate about before we get into some specific policy stuff?
I'll give you two answers. One's the broad answer and one's a very specific answer. I'll start with the specific answer first. Section 128F of the 1936 Tax Act is when I realized I was going to have to do something to help, you know, save our country. And that was the section of this act was called the public offer test. And what that meant was that corporations that issue bonds in the primary market don't have to pay withholding tax. Now, if you're not, you know, involved in treasury and tax like I was, you would not have a clue what that section of the Tax Act meant. But what it meant was that foreign banks or any corporation that lends money to Australia, the interest we pay them, they don't have to pay any tax on that here in Australia. And I was immediately like, well, hang on, if I earn interest income in my bank account or many pensioners earn interest income on their bank accounts, they've got to pay tax. And it was, and that was while I was doing my Master's of Tax Law at Sydney University. So I was sitting in the old tax law, the law building on Phillip Street in one of the bottom buildings. And I can remember it was just a moment. It was one of those sliding door moments where I thought, you know what, I'm going to have to do something about this because no one else out there on Main Street will understand it. So that was, I guess, my knowledge. So that's where I felt I could add value as a politician. And that gave me the conviction to run because our tax act is designed to make it hard. Our tax act makes it harder for small business and businesses in Australia to compete with offshore companies because they don't have to pay the same amount of tax as what onshore companies here in Australia do. And when you've got what we call arbitrage, that taxation arbitrage, Australian businesses can't compete. And as a result of these, you know, what I call reverse tariffs, it's funny because we'll talk about this later. There's a lot of discussion about Trump bringing in tariffs. We've actually got our own government has placed reverse tariffs on Australian businesses through the Tax Act by making us pay more tax here in Australia than what you do if you take your profits offshore. Now, that's the specific answer. The general answer is I want to make sure our children get the same opportunities our forefathers gave to us. I want to stand up for Australians who try to stand up for themselves. And I believe the role of government is to serve the people, not control the people. And by serving the people, that means building infrastructure sovereign infrastructure, dams, power stations, road, rail, ports, airports, telecommunications that can't compete, so they're natural monopolies. So you don't have the elasticity of choice that you might say with a small business or, you know, a greengrocer or something like that. And we've got to build that infrastructure, and that infrastructure generates recurring revenue to pay for the recurring costs of schools and hospitals. So that's, you know, that's the big picture stuff, is that we've just got to make sure we leave our children give our children the same opportunities our forefathers gave to us, because our forefathers made a lot of sacrifices to make this country the great country it is. And I'm determined, I mean, as I've gotten older, I mean, as I said, my mum passed away 10 years ago this month, you know, I know the sacrifices she made to make sure our children, you know, myself, we all got ahead, my brothers and sisters. And I'm just, you know, now that I'm older in life, I've had a fantastic youth and career, I'm just driven to make sure that we don't stuff it up.
What specific opportunities do you see young Australians today are getting taken away, are defraying?
Oh, housing affordability, number one.
That's number one.
And then obviously the opportunities. And so housing affordability and then self-reliance and teaching our children that to be able to stand on their own 2 feet, not just from an individual perspective, but from a national perspective as well. So if they've got to pay a fortune for power bills, they're having their money taken away. I did a post just this week on how superannuation funds, now one superannuation fund, but it's typical of the others, are now investing $7 out of every $10 that's going into superannuation offshore. So these opportunities that money should be invested into this country through building infrastructure, not buying infrastructure, but actually building it, so that then you can get more essential services like schools and hospitals. And, you know, from this great state of Queensland, I'm old enough to remember what the National Party, Joe Bjelke-Petersen, did when he opened up the Bowen coal basins in central Queensland. When he did that in the 60s and 70s, he basically started to create three forms of income for the state: coal royalties, the royalties from the freight trains, and then the charges, the port charges from the ships that went offshore. He did it for coal. He then did it for the bauxite deposits up in Weipa, except he wouldn't give the companies that were mining that bauxite an export license. So in order to export the bauxite, they had to evaluate it, hence the creation of Gladstone. So where now the ships have to go around to Gladstone and be turned, you know, the bauxite gets turned into aluminum or aluminium. So that generated more revenue there. Building dams, you know, all of that sort of thing. So building infrastructure creates opportunities and then for jobs. And by building infrastructure, for example, you take coal-powered fire stations, you're not just generating revenue for the state. The more coal-powered fire stations you have, the more supply you have, you're pushing down the price of energy. Energy feeds into everything. It's an input cost for everything. It makes it easier for our businesses to compete. So the opportunities for our children to also compete, set up their own small business, we want to make sure they can do that. And as I just pointed out before, they can't compete against foreign corporations if foreign corporations are paying less tax than what Australian businesses are here.
So you mentioned housing affordability is the number one problem. Just for the audience out there listening, what's in your view, what's the number one problem and what's your solution?
Okay, so the number one problem is obviously immigration. It is way too high and it's pushing out many Australians from being able to buy a house. But there's another problem as well, and there's immigration, what we know as human immigration, human capital coming in. There's also financial capital. And this is one of the things, we've got some people out there saying we should just take immigration back to zero. We can't go right back to zero right now because we don't have the skill set in this country. We would be short of tradies and short of other people doing a lot of physical work if all the immigrants were to leave overnight just like that. So we do have to lower the immigration rate. But what we also have to do is we have to understand how we got ourselves into this problem. And this is where in 1985, Paul Keating lifted what they called financial deregulation. They lifted capital controls. So that was financial capital controls. So in 1985, there was $8 billion in foreign debt between the four major banks. By 2008, there was $800 billion in foreign debt. So what that did was, and all of that money, so when Keating lifted capital controls, he said, we're not going to restrict banks from going offshore and borrowing money, right? So when I was at the Bank of Queensland, for example, the Bank of Queensland was borrowing about 60%. Its wholesale funding was about 60% offshore and only 40% onshore, right? So what that meant was for every dollar, say $1 million we lent on housing, only 400,000 of it came from domestic savings. The rest of it came from offshore. So you apply that across all the banks over that 23-year period from 1985 to 2008, $8 billion, $800 billion. it got lent against housing that drove house prices up from 3 to 4 times earnings to 10 to 12 times earnings. It then meant that two parents had to go back to work. It then led to the creation of the childcare industry, right? Now, in 2008, there was the financial GFC, financial crisis. So in order to stop the house market from crashing, because everyone had all this debt and a lot of retirees lost their superannuation, like Storm Financial and that, in order to stop house prices from crashing, Kevin Rudd allowed the parents or foreign students to buy property here, okay? And that would prop up the housing market and save the banks, right? Because the banks have an enormous amount of influence. That then started the foreign student explosion. So if you look at the foreign student numbers, it took off after the GFC. And that was designed to prop up houses in this country. So we went from lifting restrictions on financial capital in 1985, which then led to us lifting restrictions on human capital from 2008, right? I mean, we've always had immigration, but it sort of started to take off. And it's one thing, say, when we had the immigration after World War One, my great-great-parents are from the Irish potato famine, so they came here and came as settlers, as farmers, right? So it's one thing when immigrants come here, they go to the regions and they start at value adding. But if they're coming here as students and they're living on campus or just basically studying, but not at, and so increasing the demand side, but not supplying any goods and services themselves into the economy, you're going to create, you know, a services problem, which is what we've got now. And I think we're up to something like, I'll stand and be corrected on this, something like 2 million temporary visas in this country. So it's completely out of control. So that is what led to the situation we're in today. And that's what we've got to reverse.
What I don't understand what you just said was, you said that it was because the capital controls were lifted that all this money, the banks were able to get it from overseas. Surely there was a demand for the money for it to be filled. Why did they have to go? Why couldn't they just get it domestically, all that additional borrowing?
Because prior to 1985, all the banks could lend out, because they were restricted from borrowing foreign capital, right? So they could only lend out what people deposited into the bank account. And your savings was linked to earnings, right? And that's why, so for the first generation, it was like a party. So it's like if I took our children, you know, if I assume you've got children, or if we took them to the comic book shop and there was a comic book there for $5, and every week they earned $5 mowing the lawn, the most they could pay for a comic book per week would be $5. Now, if I came along and said, look, I'll lend you $20, so now they've got $25. What's that comic book worth? $25. But is their earnings increased? No. So this is the problem. So we had what they called the neoliberal or economic rationalist period, where it's like all government's bad. Let's deregulate the market. And of course, that had other consequences as well. So the Victorian State Bank collapsed in the late 80s because they used to be just a typical savings bank where they'd go and borrow, you know, people would put a term deposit or make deposits with the Victorian State Bank, and then they'd lend that money out again. Well, because the regulation, they were allowed to buy a merchant bank called Tricontinental at the end of the 80s with the SCASE boom and the bond, you know, with the heady days of the late 80s. And they bought this merchant bank, which basically collapsed, which meant that the Victorian State Bank collapsed. And a lot of Victorians moved to Queensland as a result of that. I'm sure some of your listeners have probably got parents who came from Victoria. So that reckless, it'd be like getting rid of traffic lights on the highway. Like you just.
So what I'm getting at is, if I went into a bank in 1985 for a home loan, how would it be different pre that change to after that change as a consumer trying to borrow money?
The difference would be you'd get dressed up in a suit. And this is what my father tells me, is 90 actually, in a couple of months. But back in the day, you'd have to get dressed up in a suit, and you would get a ticket in the queue, and the banks would only lend money to the most creditworthy people.
Was the deposits the same? Bigger deposits, less?
Bigger deposits, and all the banks could lend was what people, say, put into their bank account.
So dollar for dollar, one for one. So there's no fractional reserve lending, nothing. But
the fractional reserve lending is a bit of a misnomer. So banks have to have 10% equity, right? But what people think is that they just issue credit on a computer. That's not correct. The other 90% of money they lend has to come from savings or term deposits, right? Or after 1985, offshore markets, right?
So what you're saying in 1985 is that banks had far less capital to lend.
Yes.
And therefore, they were far more choosy about who they were lending it to.
Yep.
And there was far less money, people buy getting mortgages. Whereas today, because of these capital controls being lifted, a heap of cash came in from overseas.
Yes.
That encouraged the banks to lower their lending criteria, and make it easier for people to borrow, which then, of course, supply demand drove prices
asset prices up. And, of course, that was all aided and abetted about 10 years later by APRA, which was split off by the RBA, who stopped including the prices of houses and land, existing houses and existing land, in the CPI index.
So how do you put that genie back in the bottle?
Well, you got to bring back capital controls. And you couldn't do it all at once. You'd have to sort of reduce the amount the banks could borrow from offshore gradually. But the key point is, if banks can only lend what people deposit within Australia, it means that you can't live beyond your means. So it's like if our children graduated from high school, and instead of them just spending a week down at schoolies, we gave them a credit card for 50 grand. Yeah. And they went out and spent that 50 grand, but they had no income. That's reckless expenditure, right? Because you want them to be able to repay it. I mean, you want them to be able to invest it. And this was the thing. Housing, even though it's still very important, I mean, it's the most important asset you can have, is a consumption asset, in the sense that it's not a factory making, widgets and gadgets and things like that. And business banking went from about 50 or 60% of a bank's book to down to about 20 or 30%. And, of course, there's two reasons for that. A, because housing lending went up so much, and businesses now, big businesses, don't have to borrow as much and use as much debt because they rely on the equity market through superannuation. So we had this other whammy. So 1985, I just talked about the capital controls. We also had the Button Plan introduced in 1985, which is where we abolished a lot of tariffs. The Button Plan was named after Senator John Button, who was a Victorian Labor senator. And basically we said, right, we can't compete with Asia. We're going to get rid of tariffs, and we're just going to let all our manufacturing go offshore. Now, that along with the privatisation of our infrastructure, because our state governments used to train a lot of apprentices as well through the electricity board and things like that, we've lost our skill set. So 40 years later, in 2025, all of those people that were getting apprentices. So my best mate left school 40 years ago this year, and he left school to become a diesel mechanic. So when I started grade eight, we had four classes. When I finished grade eight, we had about down to one or two classes. My sister, who's 6 years older than me, when she started grade eight, she had four classes at high school in Chinchilla. When she finished grade 12, she had half a class, because most of the men, or the men, left to go and get apprenticeships or trades or get out there in the real world. Today, of course, we now have most of our students go on to university. But what we've got is all of that last generation of where we had more people getting trades, adding skills, real skills, are now retiring. And as a result, we're losing our, what I call, people with the skill sets who are on the tools. They're all now, retiring. And what have we got? We've got, broken, brainwashed young people with a hex debt with no real life skills. I mean, they've gone to university and look, there's important degrees you can get at university, obviously medicine, engineering, architecture. Yeah, they are valuable then. But, other degrees like sports management, for example, we don't need to be studying sports management. Even things like nursing. My mother became a nurse because she was taught in the ward. Things like that, we don't necessarily be taught in a classroom. You're better off being taught on the workshop floor or in the hospital or in the classroom. So that is the thing. We're de-skilling. Now, add to the asset in prices. So there was that 1985 and that education thing was the Dawkins Plan in 1990, where the government started funding education. So that's where we went away from. So take the Button Plan and the Dawkins Plans together. We've gone from being on the tools and having real life skills and, skills that you can use in a manufacturing industry or something like that, to being, classroom skills and all the softer skills that don't necessarily add value. And then the real kicker on top of that is superannuation. So that's today, you're taking 12%. Soon to be in July, you're going to be, the government, is going to force you to give up 12% of your income and give it to somebody you've never met. And you won't get it back until you're 67. And there's no guarantee you're going to get it back until you're 67. Now, 12% of your top line income for people on an average wage is 50 to 60, if not 100% of their actual savings. So you're reducing their savings capacity to even buy a house. And superannuation is a false economy, because if house prices are going up 7%, you need your superannuation to go up by 10% just to break even. Because remember, you can only save for a house after you pay tax. So if you earn $100,000 a year and pay, it's not quite $30,000 tax at 100, but let's say it is, just for the sake of simplicity, you need to be earning, if you want to save, buy $1 million house, it's expensive, but it's not far off the median price of Brisbane. Prices in Brisbane now, you might need to save $70,000 a year. You've got to make $100,000. So superannuation doesn't actually generate a 10% return. They get about a 6 or 7% of return, but you're falling behind in your capacity to buy a house. So what we've seen is now 40% of people who retire, and these figures are a couple of years old, this was pre-COVID actually, 40% of people retire now retire with a mortgage. That's up from 10% in 1992. Wow. So we've increased asset prices, we've reduced earnings capacity, we've reduced our productive capability, and this is how we're becoming, our economy is becoming more vulnerable to external shocks.
I'm a big property guy, right?
Yeah.
And I want to know, how is Jared and People First going to fix the housing affordability crisis without crashing the market? Because in my opinion, a lot of Australians' wealth versus overseas like the US and stuff is held in real estate. We are a pro-property country, right? Sure. And we've heard of, you know, net zero immigration and all these types of things. And immigration has been said that that's what's propping this real estate market. So what are some of the things that you would do to try and one, fix it without crashing it?
Okay, so the first two things would be obviously lower immigration and fixed capital controls. But then what we need to do is to actually be able to put more money into people's pockets, especially young people's pockets, so that they can afford housing and get into housing. And we want to lift the tax-free threshold to $40,000. It's currently $18,200. So if we lifted the tax-free threshold from $18,200 to $40,000, that would save about $3,500 a year. We'll put $3,500 more into people's pockets who earn that money. Secondly, we'd make superannuation voluntary so that young people, if they want to pay off their house, can pay off, save for a deposit or pay off their house, they can pay it off faster or save for a deposit faster.
So you're saying use their superannuation contribution now to buy a house.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's best form of retirement is to own your own house.
So would that be governed by, like, let's say there's a super contribution is 12% now. That 12%, they can't just go and set up the wall down the pub. But that 12% needs to be allocated to a dedicated mortgage account or something along those lines.
So no, 12%, they can keep it. If they want to waste it at a pub, that's their bad luck. They'll get the pension when they retire.
What's the long-term impact of that? They get the pension when they retire and that's that?
Yeah.
Is there any more impacts that you can see? Because let's be straight. The majority of people do not know how to manage money, right? Mm-hmm. And the reality is, I think, like, we've seen it during COVID, right? People got some handouts. What did they do? Went to Harvey Norman, bought the TVs, bought the blenders, bought all the fancy things, right? They didn't actually go out and save it or invest it. So how would that affect long-term impact in regards to, I guess, the quality of life and the pressure on government in regards to funding what somebody has spent? Because we're assuming that people are going to be putting it into property, but the reality is boats and cars are a lot more sexy.
I'm not assuming that at all, actually. I'm assuming that a lot of people will go out and spend it. And you know what they do when they get their lump sum, those people who spend it throughout their life, you know, those same people do when they get their lump sum super at 60, they go out and buy a boat or take an overseas holiday anyway. When you say that, I disagree with you. I think many people out there will save for their own house, but you're right. There's a large number of people that won't be responsible and they will spend it. But I don't see why those people, the people that do want to get ahead, should be held back by those irresponsible. And I think there's more people who are responsible than not. But here's the key point. The cost of superannuation concessions, tax concessions today are $60 billion. The cost of the pension, and that mainly goes... most of that goes to the upper 20% of income retirees. They won't get the pension anyway. The cost of the pension is $55 billion. That goes to the bottom 50% of income retirees plus 20% on a part pension. So the cost of, and the income tax retirement review predicted this a few years ago, and this year it's just happened. Jim Chalmers, it was not spoken about. The media were very quiet about it last December. But in the MIEFO report, when they came out with a tax expenditure statement, the combined tax concessions for superannuation was $60 billion. Now, add to that the cost of managing superannuation. So the last figure done by the Productivity Commission about 6 years ago, it should need to be updated, but it was about 1%. The cost of managing superannuation across the economy is $30 billion. All right, so add that to the $60 billion. That is a huge amount of money. That's almost the same amount of money we would spend on defense we spend on an army of financial engineers in their ivory palaces. On top of that, you now have $4 trillion in superannuation. $3 trillion of that is controlled by industry and retail funds. About 30, predominantly the bulk of that is controlled by about 20 industry and retail funds who are not elected. Right, that's one of our policies of people first. But guess what? If you control $3 trillion in capital, you control industry. And every time you land on a plane or you go, and as many of your listeners will be out there, they've gone to meetings and they've had to do a welcome to country at a boardroom meeting, or they'll land on a plane, they have to get the acknowledgement of country, or they have all these sort of woke things coming into corporations. That is because the people running companies today are being driven by ideology and not productivity. And we cannot have, you read a set of financial statements today, there's more words in a set of financial statements. If you get on there and read a set of, an annual report from a company, there's more words in there than there are numbers, right? As someone who's been a financial accountant for 30 odd years, I can tell you that is not right. Okay, I want to see the numbers, I don't want to see the verbiage.
Say the verbiage, do you mean woke ideology in there, or are you talking just language generally?
Oh, language in generally. You know, they'll talk about, how many men are employed to women. I mean, there's an entire agency in Canberra called the Gender Workplace Equality Agency that employs about 30 people. And you have to, if you're a certain size company, you have to report to this agency how many men and women
ticking
you're
employed.
Ticking all those things.
Bullshit.
You know, in the Voice, for example, most companies gave $2 million or millions of dollars to the yes vote, not the no vote. They should have stayed right out of it. I go and get cash out of my bank's, which is Commonwealth Bank ATM now. There's a little acknowledgement of country and a little plaque next to the ATM. You know, what are they spending money on that stuff for? But this is the problem when you control $3 trillion. And most of it now, as I said earlier, is 7 out of every $10 is being invested offshore. Now, Bob Hawke said when he brought in superannuation.
Out of super.
Yeah.
So 7 out of $10
of new super
is going overseas, not being invested into Australian infrastructure and ownership of stuff.
That's correct. Yeah.
I liked what you said before. And I love this policy, the superannuation one, by the way, because I think at the end of the day, if you want to take the money now, you should be able to, right? Because we're basically saying to people, live an average life now, thinking that you have this money that's devaluing, in my opinion, every day, every week, every year.
Yeah.
To say that you're going to have 300 grand in your superannuation account at 65, right? But what you said is true. If the people are going to spend it on that now, they're most likely going to spend it on that then. So the decision is, do you want to live a half decent life and enjoy while you're young? Right? Or do you want to live an average life now to then try and live in a half decent life when you're 65 and enjoy those things? And in my opinion, I rather enjoy life when you have the health and you can actually go and travel the world and do what you want. I went to Europe last year and I had this realization of when I was there and we're in Italy and we're overlooking the water. And I remember this guy, he was about 70-odd years old, and he was walking around with an oxygen tank, and I was just like, is that what retirement is going to look like? And I think it's an
interesting policy
and very good,
and it's really interesting. So that $40,000, I'd like to get it to $50,000 on that tax free, but if you earn $40,000 today, you pay about $3,500 income tax. You'll pay, once it hits 12%, $4,800 in super. So let's just round that up to $5,000. You're disposable income from $40,000 goes back to $31,500. Now, that if you're not already below the cost of living at $40,000, which most people probably already are, you're certainly going to go below the cost of living. So we're putting, for people on median incomes, what we're doing is we're delaying today for the future, but we're driving people below the poverty line, which is then going to make it harder to keep their job. Because if they've got a flat tire or they needed a dental fix or they've got to, own a house, I mean, you don't want them losing their house. Like taking away $8,500 out of $40,000 when it costs you $40,000 to live is actually nonsensical. But if I can quote the Australian Superannuation Financial Association, the median balance for women aged 60 to 64 for superannuation is $158,000. Now, those figures are a couple of years old, but that's after superannuation's 30 years old. Women who've been... So in other words, the assets test for going on a part pension is $312,000. So half the women aged 60 to 64 aren't anywhere near even going off the pension. So superannuation isn't doing its job of getting people off the pension. The same percentage of retirees, if, I think it's a little bit higher actually, are on a full pension today than what there was in 1992. So all we're doing is sending $30 billion in fees to the financial engineers. Tax concessions to wealthy, and I'm one of them. I shouldn't be getting tax concessions in my superannuation. I don't need it, especially when someone that earns more than $18,200 is paying 16 cents in the dollar. When they're $34,000 below the poverty line. We want these people who get out of bed every day and put their nose to the grindstone on low incomes to be keeping their head above water. Because I can tell you, it's the low income earners that keep the wheels turning in this country. I grew up in Chinchilla. I did fruit picking. I did, worked at the Royal Exchange when I was at university. All those roles, hospitality, shift workers, the cleaners, they're the people that keep the wheels turning. And if they're getting out of bed for an average income of $60,000 or $70,000 a year, I want to make sure that they keep their head above the water. And it's completely wrong that we give generous cash. And Dick Smith will admit this, right? He says it's ridiculous. He pays next to no tax on his superannuation. He's a multimillionaire. He puts ads in the paper about a great guy, Dick. It is completely ridiculous that our tax system gives generous tax, $60 billion worth of tax concessions to super, and yet we have $55 billion for the pension. I mean, we've got to encourage those people who are doing it tough, who still get up, when they could be sitting in, probably if they worked the system, could get 40 or 50 grand in handouts or faked an injury to get on NDIS. These guys are actually still working, and we've got, there's some other policies I reckon I'd love to lift the tax-free threshold all the way to 100 if I could. I probably couldn't get there in one go, but I reckon I could probably get to 65 or 70 without.
Back to the 1985, the lifting the lid on the bringing on offshore capital. I mean, is that one of your policies moving forward now? You like to try and put that genie back in the bottle, so to speak? And if so, have you had any, would the feedback be interesting from the banks? I mean, obviously the more money they can get in and then get out is whether they can profitable. So, I mean, it'd be interesting to try and see how that would work.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, tough titty. I mean, it's the federal government gives the banks the banking license. We'll make the rules, thanks very much. If they don't like it, then next time there's a GFC, we won't bail them out, and it'll be good night, banks. But what we'll do is instead, what we want to do is this is where the infrastructure bank comes in. Now, are you guys familiar with the balance sheet?
Not really. Not intimately.
Right. Okay. Well, you got an asset. Okay. You got an asset over here, right? So that's your asset. Then we have this thing over here called debt and equity. You know what another word for debt and equity is?
We're familiar with balance sheets, just not the Aussie balance
sheet. Okay, so it's called capital, right? Mm-hmm. Now, you'll often hear, we've always relied on foreign capital. You hear politicians say that rubbish all the time. That's a complete and utter insult to our pioneering forefathers. The words of our national anthem is wealth for toil, right? Our wealth is basically from hard labor, right? People working out there, turning the soil into crops, et cetera, et cetera. What we want to do is replace foreign. So we've gone in 1985, we had 14 million people. That's our asset, right? Today we have 28 million people over here. We have filled the credit side up. So for every debit, there's a credit. We have filled the credit side up with foreign debt, okay, instead of domestic equity, right? Now, our forefathers, when they went off in World War II and fought to save our country, and our pioneering forefathers built this country up in terms of modern Australia, they built the title. Title is equity, right? Mortgage is debt. Title is equity. So back to your asset. If I say I'm a farmer, I've got a tractor and I'm going to audit the farmer, I go out to the farm, I'll look for a tractor, right? When I say I've got debt and equity, what is the real instrument under debt and equity? It's either a mortgage or it's a debt or equity. We have the equity to this country. So instead of using what our Keating did, is sold Australia out, because he said, we're no going to longer use domestic equity. We're going to allow foreign banks to lend us their paper, okay, in exchange for our hard assets. And that's completely ridiculous. So we want to replace that foreign debt with domestic equity. So just in the same way as public companies, BHP might issue new shares to build a new coal mine, we want to issue new shares to build dams, power stations, road, rail, ports, airports, and telecommunications. Maybe not so much telecommunications anymore, thanks to Elon Musk and Starlink. But let's look at the other six assets. We issue that. So the way we do that is we issue one share and call it untapped wealth. Start an infrastructure bank in Canberra. Canberra, the infrastructure bank, will now lend to the federal or state government for any of those six assets. So let's take a dam, for example. Let's say it costs $1 billion to build a big dam, right? What we currently do is borrow $1 billion offshore, and then that means the first $1 billion we make in wealth from that dam, we've got to repay offshore. right? Plus 25 years interest at 4%, say, just those figures that I'm here, that's another $1 billion in interest. We've just given away $2 billion in wealth, untapped wealth, because we are using someone else's paper instead of ours. We are paying another country to use their printing press when we should be issuing our own script.
And we're not even taxing them, you were saying,
On the interest. That's exactly right.
So there's no withholding tax to them on the interest either. So there's a double whammy.
Absolutely. So many of your listeners would be familiar with the stupid scenario we have with renewables at the moment, where we're shutting down our own homegrown coal-powered fire stations and then buying renewables made offshore. And then I think 75% of those renewables are owned by foreign companies, right? What we did with our energy system, which most of you can understand, we did that with our financial markets back in 1985. Okay, we sold out and we're letting other countries exploit us like we're an African third world country. And we've got to stop that.
Finish that damn story, though. So you got the $1 billion, right? And we're taking the money from offshore bank.
Yeah.
We're paying them interest offshore. They're not paying us any tax on the interest that we're paying.
Yeah, that's right.
And we've lost $1 billion in the capital and the interest.
Yeah.
How would the infrastructure bank work? So Canberra lends the state $1 billion.
Yeah. So the infrastructure bank will lend the state government $1 billion for 50 years. Now, it won't just lend $1 billion like that. It will lend like $5 million a week. So it'll be a work in progress initially. So obviously you'll be paying wages, you'll be buying a couple of D10s to, scoop the, push the dirt out, concrete, so
progress payments.
Yeah, progress payments.
And the interest payments on that come back to the Fed.
Yeah, that's
which
right.
Which is owned by the people.
Exactly. And then that infrastructure bank will then make a profit. So we'll be start generating earnings that stay here in Australia, rather than interest that goes offshore.
And it's owned by the Australian people.
And the initial capital for the infrastructure bank?
That will be issued from just in the same way companies issue new shares, we will issue new equity/ infrastructure bonds.
So what the whole premise here is the Australian people own this land.
Absolutely.
And so if somebody wants to come along and build a mine or build a infrastructure project, we say, no problem, we're going to create shares. You're going to buy the shares or... the shares are going to be owned by the people.
Yep.
And then you issue the debt to the state.
We issue the debt to the state. So the people will own the bank, but it won't be for mines. It's got to be for those seven sovereign assets. That's very strict.
Yeah, got it.
But so just stay with me here, right?
You have to slow it down for us, dummies.
Yeah, sorry, guys. And some of your listeners will have listened to this a couple of times. I know it's complex, but it's really, really important.
It's a great idea, and I'm loving it. I just want to make sure people don't miss it.
Yeah. Now that's known in the business as quantitative easing. Right. So
which part?
Issuing the infrastructure bonds.
Okay.
Right. Because remember, it's called we've doubled our debits over here, 14 million people to 28 million people. We have to increase the volume of capital, right, in the system to match the increasing size of the population. 1937 Banking Royal Commission, the real Banking Royal Commission into banking in Australia, said the central bank should always control the volume of capital in the system. 1985, Paul Keating abolished that and let foreign banks control the volume of capital. We're going back to using our equity instead of debt, right? Now, where was I with that? Now, the reason why we've got to do that is because what the RBA, currently our RBA only uses qualitative easing. That's where they change the price of money on the first Tuesday of every month, i.e. where they manipulate interest rates. That is speculation, nothing short of speculation. The only people that make money out of that is who? Banks, right? They're not making anything out of that, right? Now, inflation is a relative number. We had, because of the ridiculous scenario in COVID where they printed $300 billion and paid people to stay at home and get brainwashed by the premiers, we had a drop in supply and an increase in demand. And that drop in supply wasn't just COVID. That goes all the way back to the 1980s when we got rid of manufacturing. So our supply has been dropping all the time while demand has been increasing all the time through rising immigration, right? So immigration's the difference between demand and supply. Sorry, inflation's the difference between demand and supply. What the RBA does, they manage the demand side of the economy. And they do that by punishing hardworking Australians through no fault of their own. It's a form of tax. They don't call it a tax, but it's a form of tax, right? So after their stupid behaviour throughout COVID, where the reckless economic management, they have punished hardworking Australians by lifting interest rates 14 times to drive demand down. Now, that's an austerity measure. Why is our government imposing austerity on Australians after the crap they went through in COVID? What we need to do is have a productivity measure to lift supply. Because if we're going to increase immigration, and we've already done that, forget about stopping it now. We've gone from 14 million people to 28 million people in the last 40 years, right? We've got to increase supply. That is why we need this infrastructure bank as well, because by doing it this way, we will lift supply and lift productivity. And that's really, really important. And now, the naysayers, the economic rationalists will go, oh, that's reckless. You can't print money out of thin air. That's complete rubbish, right? All money comes out of thin air.
It's what companies do every day when they IPO or they raise capital.
Exactly.
That's how the whole capital markets work.
Here's the thing. It's not whether or not you issue credit out of thin air. It's what you match the credit against. Correct. Now, you understand the difference between secured and unsecured lending. Mm-hmm. The infrastructure bank will enforce secured lending. What our government currently does now, they just go and borrow money from offshore, and what do they secure it against? Our children's taxes. Our tax base and our children. Our children are going to inherit the debt because of our stupidity today, and I'm determined to stop that, right? So what we need to do is to actually bring the infrastructure bank in, but when we issue that new credit, we have to issue it against an asset, and we issue it against assets that come out of thin air. So what's the assets that come out of thin air?
Yep.
Rain?
Yeah.
Sunlight?
Yep.
Soil?
Mm-hmm.
Yep, that's tidal. We have tidal over all that. Every time it rains, right, if you take livestock, for example, if you stick a bull in a paddock with 20 cows, you come back a year later, you've probably got, you know, hopefully 20, 18 calves. Every year, Mother Nature is giving us recurring wealth for free out of the sky, and that falls across our 7 million square kilometres. Now, what we currently do is all that wealth that comes out of the sky, thanks to Mother Nature, we give to the foreign banks, right? Because we are stupid. We are dumb and we are stupid and weak because we fell for Keating's garbage in 1985. We need to be securing that to our children. Our forefathers gave us that title, and we've got to make sure we give the title of those assets, that recurring wealth, to our children. And that is why that's what the infrastructure bank will do, because every time you've got a dam, then you've got start irrigating, you'll increase land values, increase more land tax, you'll produce more crops, you'll reduce the number of floods and droughts, you'll make it a wealthier country. Likewise with power stations, you burn our coal, cheaper energy, generating revenue for the state governments, and cheaper energy for our small business. We're giving our children opportunities. So that is where, that's the solution. Now, that's the infrastructure bank. I want a public bank over here, like we used to have with the Commonwealth Bank. And that's basically where we go back to, you know, and if we start generating more earnings over here and create more small business, we'll have more savings. We don't need to go offshore anymore because we can just lend out, you know, when people retire and they put their money in at fixed interest at 4%, the bank will take it and lend it out at 6%, but we're not living beyond our means. Yep. Now, the profit from the Commonwealth, the public bank here and the infrastructure bank over here will then go into a development bank. And that will then fund more loans to things like councils to build sewerage works and things like that. But the beauty of it is when the councils, say state government's building a hospital, instead of them borrowing money from a private bank and then all that interest, like I said, the 25 years at 4%, all that interest going offshore, guess what? The interest then goes back to the development bank. The development bank goes back to the federal government, and we reduce our taxes even more because we're actually retaining the earnings from this country. This massive country, 7 million square kilometres with only 28 million people living in it, we're retaining our earnings here from the productivity, our own productivity, instead of paying it offshore to these foreign banks for nothing more than printing money out of thin air.
Not worse. Sorry.
Why don't more people know about you?
Because...
Like you can obviously sit here, and that's a lot of information for us to take in, right?
But
you can
see, Eric, for the
right?
system.
But you can see... obviously the finance background, right? And like when I listen to you, I can't help but to think of someone like a Donald Trump at the same time, who has a similar background, but that business finance mind, right? Like not anyone can think the way you do, right? Just because they have some policies and like the whole, like I look at a country, like it's a business. You know, like, right. Like you said, it's a balance sheet. There's financial statements to a country. And I think that it hasn't been looked at that way for many, many years.
Yeah. And just to add to that, like people first has been around since
2024?
Just last year.
You obviously haven't come
3 months.
You haven't come up with this concept in the last 3 months. You've been banging this drum for quite a while.
I've been banging this drum when I was in the Liberal Party for 5 years. I was secretary of the backbench committee. I took it to Jim Chalmers. I took it to Josh Frydenberg. I took it to Stephen Kennedy, the head of Treasury. His words to me at the end of it was, we don't want Japanification of Australia. I was like, what do you mean you don't want the Japanification of Australia? I hate Japan. Well, you don't want high-speed rail going everywhere, being on time and all that? Of course we are. But just back to your comment about us being a business, but we're not in the business of profits. We're in the business of services. So our business is delivering schools and hospitals and infrastructure and getting out of people's lives.
It's delivering lifestyle.
Yeah, delivering lifestyle. So the profits we are is freedom, you know, greater choice, you know, high standard of living. And that's what we do by retaining that earnings. We can lower taxes, empower people not just to have more money to buy their own houses, but empower our entrepreneurs to run small businesses and succeed there as well.
It's that time of year again at Unemployable, where we're opening up our Unemployable Business Coaching Program. It's over a 12-month period, and with that, you get private one-on-one coaching, group coaching, as well as private and live events throughout the year. You could get private coaching with me, and not only me, but our panel of experts that we have put together. These panel of experts have been in our network and are the exact people that we use in our business successes. People from branding, sales, marketing, our lawyers, our accountants, everyone that has helped build our businesses, you have access to. If this sounds of interest, go to www.unemployable.com.au/coaching and register your interest to see if it's a fit for you and us. Hope to see you there.
Because we need these people to be able to live in these cities. And that's what's so sad is that, like you said there, the people who are teachers and nurses and stuff can't afford to live there anymore. Oh. And we need them here.
Yeah.
But the one I want to loop back because this is all fantastic. The other thing that you spoke about before we rolled tape and we were chatting to you was there's a huge, and I get it all the time on social media, and we heard it when Pauline and Malcolm were here about how Australians in their mind have this idea that we get paid nothing for our liquid natural gas and other resources. And you were explaining how that's actually a misnomer. It's not that we get nothing. It's the tax incentives and the tax structures that result in that. But we do have royalties and all that stuff. Can you explain to us how we're not getting screwed over?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So there's a conception out there that we don't get anything for our minerals. That's not true. So our minerals that are state owned on the land, the state governments charge royalties. Now, for example, here in Queensland on coal, the royalty on coal up to $100, sale price of $100 is 7%. The royalty on coal between 100 and 150, I think off the top of my head, is 12.5%. It then goes to 15% from 150 to 200, and then right up to over 400, it goes to 30%. Yeah, gold, I think, is 5% in WA. I think iron ore is 5% in WA.
That's just the royalty, though.
That's just the royalty. Now,
there's other taxes as well that they pay.
Yeah, there's other taxes as well. So, and then on top of that, obviously, if they still make a profit, they'll pay 30 cents in the dollar on the profit they make. They pay payroll tax on all the people they employ, and then they pay GST on all the dozers, the utes, all the expenditure that they spend. They're paying GST. Now, where they're not paying tax on our resources is on offshore gas.
Tax or royalties?
Royalties, yeah.
Royalties.
So what we've got instead of a flat royalty on the top line for our offshore gas, now our offshore gas is managed by the federal government, not the state government, is what they call this petroleum resource rent tax. Now that was designed in a way to make sure that effectively it was almost impossible that they would ever pay, you know, a petroleum resource rent tax. And that's because they're allowed to index the cost of construction. So if it took 10 years to build an oil rig, say $1 million a year for 10 years, so it was $10 million, they can appreciate the actual cost of that $1 million.
Appreciate
it. So they can index the cost over time, which basically means if you're indexing at the rate of inflation, about 4%. But here's the thing. What they do is they set up offshore loans on that $1 million, so from 10 years ago, and they'll borrow money at, say, 8 or 9% from offshore, and that gets added to the $1 million every year plus the indexation. So as I said before, you know, 25 years at 4%, you double it. When it's 9%, it'll only take 11 years to double the costs, right? So effectively, it's almost impossible under the petroleum resource tax to pay any petroleum resource rent tax, right? So get rid of all that complexity. So this is what people first want to do, and just charge an offshore royalty between 5 and 10% on offshore gas sales. Now, Chevron got busted about a decade ago by the tax office and their dodgy transfer pricing. The ATO need to lift their game, by the way. They don't do enough on transfer pricing with multinationals, but then they go hard after our small businesses here. But Chevron were charging 9% on intercompany loans when they borrowed from their bank at about 2 or 3%. And they got caught out only because of emails that admitted they got caught out. But the big thing about, a lot of people love to bag our mining companies here in Australia. They pay the most amount of tax, more amount of tax than anyone else. It's all the, it's this going back to this withholding tax system that I spoke, which why I ran initially. You take Pfizer. So in 2022, they made $1.4 billion in sales here. They transferred about $1 billion of that back to Ireland. Now, the withholding tax rate on royalties paid to Ireland is 10 cents. Ireland has a company tax rate of 12.5 cents. So that means 10 plus 12.5 is 22.5. Less the 30 cents they pay here, they save 7.5 cents. So it's called a 7.5 cent arbitrage on $1 billion. That's $75 million. But as it actually turns out that they get a credit on the 10% withholding tax they paid here, back in Ireland. So they're only paying actually 12.5 cents all up, 10% here and 2.5 cents in Ireland. So they're saving 17.5 cents shifting that money offshore. Now, whether it's Pfizer, whether it's McDonald's, whether it's General Motors, you take when we shut down our car industries, no one ever asked how much money in interest, royalties and rent did General Motors pay back to Detroit or one of their subsidiaries in an offshore tax haven. It was enough to make sure they never made a profit here. Because if they made a profit here, they'd pay 30 cents in a dollar. The tax treaties with the US between 0 and 10, some of them are 0, so they would get a 30 cent arbitrage, tax arbitrage, by shifting that money offshore. That is the real killer, notwithstanding the offshore gas, that's also a problem, but the onshore minerals isn't as bad.
How much would it, like if you did a, just let's say it's 10% royalty for the offshore gas, if you implemented that and there was no way to get around it, how much would that bring back to the Australian economy in your estimation?
It would be in billions. I couldn't tell you how much, but I would estimate that if we were to lift our withholding tax rate much higher from say about 10% to 20%, we would be collecting, if we didn't at least collect $10 or $20 billion, I'd be very surprised.
Because I think I saw some comparison with a Middle Eastern country. Was it Oman or somewhere?
Yeah, Qatar.
Qatar.
Yeah.
And we've got, have we got similar oil reserves there or like what's the comparison?
So this was one of the first things I looked into back in 2019 when I became a senator. Qatar's gas is very shallow and it's a better high quality product than our gas, which is offshore in deep waters, and it is a lot more expensive to drill, and as well as that, our wages are also much more expensive as well, because Qatar's right in the middle of the Arabian Peninsula there where, you know, it's just they can get cheap labor from India and Bangladesh and places like that. So it's certainly a something we should benchmark against, but we won't collect as much money because our gas is deeper and it's not as high quality, and obviously it's further to the market. So to ship it to Japan, you know, Japan from WA, I think is, you know, 14 hours of shipping versus say from Qatar to Europe may only be a few hours through the Suez Canal.
And these offshore gas and so forth are in Australian waters, hence why we can.
Yeah.
So why is this massive difference from offshore to onshore?
Because of the difference between state and federal governments, right? So Keating, yet again, I think it was Keating who designed the petroleum resource rent tax in the late 80s. Yet again, these guys don't understand numbers. They didn't realise, and they were all falling over themselves to get the industry up and running. And Howard gave away, he signed contracts with Japan in early 2000 that were extremely cheap. It wasn't just the royalty issue. Some of these contracts are 20 or 30 year contracts. And of course, they don't understand that the how powerful exponential interest is, right? If you're increasing something of 2 or 3% every year over 20 years, suddenly the price, if you're getting, as you pointed out before, Eric, that the actual real dollar value is actually decreasing the longer it goes on. And so you've got the real, the SAR price not going anywhere, but under the petroleum resource rent tax, the costs are being appreciated every year, but the sale contracts weren't designed with an indexation, an inflation. Just gave it away.
I don't understand that. Like, that's basic 101.
It's just, well, that's with politicians who don't really fucking...
But we see it with renewables, right? Like, we're shutting down our own, homegrown power stations that use homegrown resources because we're, obsessed with climate change, right? We're destroying our own economy. And we did it with the financial... People sort of jump up and down about immigration, but what they don't understand about immigration is we did human capital, lifted controls on human capital around 2008. We lifted controls on financial capital in 1985. And that's what led to the human capital crisis.
I want to talk about your view on state and federal governments generally in a minute, because you have some pretty strong views around that, and probably COVID, I think, woke Australians up to realise how much power the states can have. But I just want to just cap for listeners. We won't have time to go into immigration more deeply, but I'd encourage you guys to listen to Gerard's full policies, right, for his party by going to the website unemployable.com.au/Rennick, and you can get a full, 25-minute podcast that goes through all 26 policies. But just on the immigration, you've got you're proposing a cap on immigration, that they have to go into regional areas when they come in, a total ban on extremists coming in, deport all illegals, abolish the appeals process, no dodgy education providers, which is just pumping numbers up, and 10 years you've got to be here before you can get benefits, basically. So that all mostly makes a lot of sense to me. So go and listen to the full thing. But, I want to change gears to COVID for a minute. There's so much we could talk about here with you. There's just so many rabbit holes. Like, that's just one little area. COVID, I think, changed this country in a lot of ways. It certainly woke a lot. If there's a few positives, it woke a lot of people up politically, I think. Yeah. I know I didn't really give a shit about politics until COVID, and they took my freedoms, and that's my number one value in life. And I was one of those people that took it for granted, and then we saw all of a sudden that the Australian Prime Minister didn't really run the country anymore, that the states did, that they became czars. You've got some pretty strong ideas around the cost of and the way that we are set up. Can you sort of speak to those quickly about how we've got so many layers of government and the cost and all that?
I actually raised this issue prior to COVID. So in my maiden speech, I called for a federation convention or a constitutional convention. I ran to change it to federation convention.
We actually put that on the page, your maiden speech. Yeah. If you want to watch it, where that podcast is, we've put it there as well.
Because I said there's nothing more destructive in this country than the ambiguous responsibilities and the vertical fiscal imbalance between federal and state governments. I mean, we've got two health departments, two education departments, two environment departments, two water departments, two...
money.
Two tourism. So... we've got a duplication of our bureaucracy, right? So yet again, I said our job is to deliver services. And as I said in my maiden speech, over the last 40 years, we've sold all the infrastructure that provides services. And then we've marched on into the family home, the classroom, the bedroom, COVID into the doctor's waiting room, superannuation into the boardroom, telling people how to live their lives. So we no longer provide services. We impose regulation.
Wake up, Australia.
Yeah, so we've gone from serving the people to controlling the people, and that is directly related to the size of the bureaucracy in this country. And there's no greater example of that than the duplication of roles and responsibilities between state and federal governments. Now, add to that the Franklin Dam decision, right? And you may go, what does the Franklin Dam decision got to do with the price of eggs in China? Everything. Because in 1983, and this is another one of these killer policies that Hawke brought in, the Hawke-Keating government brought in, that has had devastating impacts on this country that people don't realise. 1983, and this isn't about the environment, whether or not you think that Franklin Dam should be dammed or not, Franklin River should have been dammed or not. This is about the powers of the federal and state government. 1983, Paul Keating went to the High Court and said, anytime we sign a foreign treaty, we can override the powers of the states. Because under the Constitution 5129, the federal government's responsible for foreign treaties. They signed a foreign treaty, UNESCO, to protect the environment. Hawke said, we have to protect the Franklin River under this treaty. So they went and did a deal with the United Nations. It's at the Franklin Dam. It's now a UNESCO protected world site, heritage site. You can't dam it. So that took away. So the states under our federation, the states have plenary powers, right? So they give powers to the federal government, not the other way around. Now, the reason why that really matters is because you cannot get anything built. So you know how I said before, we'd have the infrastructure bank, the dams, and state governments build dams. We've had one dam built in Queensland since that decision, and that was the Burdekin, the one up in Bundaberg. It's escaped my mind, but it had to come down. It got built and came down anyway. Paradise Dam, sorry. Now, I'll give you a recent example of how that's impacted us. There was a gold mine in New South Wales last year that spent $190 million, paid the state government $190 million to get environmental approvals to build a gold mine. It then went to the federal government, who then kiboshed it on cultural grounds, right? Because every time you want to get something done in this country, not only do you have to go get approvals from the state government, the state, once that's done, you've then got to get a second lot of approvals from the federal government. Now, do you think the federal government that's manned by, you know, third or fourth generation bureaucrats brainwashed with woke ideology are going to ever approve another dam or gold mine or anything like that in this country ever again?
Never.
Absolutely not. And that's because the Franklin Dam decision allowed the federal government to, under any treaty they sign with the United Nations or whoever, to block any development or progress in this country.
It's almost like we need to set the Constitution on fire and start it again, because it's all just messed up.
Hence the convention. So, and I've changed that from a constitutional convention to a federation convention, because there's two things. One would be constitutional issues, but the other thing is there's a lot of things we can change without touching the Constitution. That would be low-hanging fruit. So, for example, I've got a policy, like if it was left to me, let's take health to the Fed, give health responsibility for funding health to the federal government and give education back to the state governments. Now, the reason why I say that is that education is a competition of ideas. Health, however, is very inelastic. If I'm bitten by a big black snake out back somewhere, I'm not going to get on the phone and look for the cheapest hospital across Australia, am I? I'm going to get to the closest hospital. So there's very, you know, yeah, there's inelasticity of choice. So there's not a lot of competition in health. You're going to go to the closest hospital, right? Down here in the Gold Coast, even, you've got the choice between public and private, but that's it. You're not going to drive to Adelaide because it's going to be $10 cheaper. So, but then likewise, and then because health now, we currently manage federally Medicare, the PBS scheme, private hospitals, the NDIS, aged care. Why not just wrap it all into one and then fund your local? So you've got the Gold Coast region down here, that's one health area, Metro South, Metro North, and then you give money to those regions and then they manage it at the operational level on the ground. Likewise with education, we've got this argument all the time between public and private school funding. Just give it all back to the states and say you've got to give the same amount of money to every student. You can scale it based on, you know, the poverty, but that would be much more transparent. And I don't want the national curriculum being designed in Canberra, because they're pushing all this stuff through the national curriculum that then gets pushed on to principals, that then gets pushed on to teachers. And where's the parents pushing back on this? They're not there, because they're back at work. The second parent's back at work, right? So we've got to get rid of the national curriculum. But in that little switcheroo, and these numbers are about 5 years old, it would cost the federal government $50 billion to pick up health, and we'd save $30 billion by ditching education. So the federal government would be $20 billion worse off, and the state governments would be $20 billion better off. What we do in exchange for that is state governments get rid of payroll tax, which is a stupid tax, and we bring back stamp duty on share trading, which is a tax on speculation. So about 40 to 50% of the market today is traded by high-frequency foreign traders. We should bring back a 1% stamp duty on share transactions.
Yeah.
To people who hold shares, I'll say if you hold your CBAs or your BHPs, the amount of money you will save in payroll tax, you will get increased dividends and will be much more productive. Payroll tax is a stupid tax. So just those three ideas alone, apart from getting rid of the duplication of the bureaucracies, would save billions and make us much more productive, because we wouldn't have to go through two sets of regulations.
Yeah, a lot of our entrepreneurs listening to this, one of the most frustrating taxes is, you know, they hit $1 million payroll,
yep,
and now they get payroll tax. So
yep,
they're actually disincentivized to create jobs.
Yeah, they go to Sri Lanka or Philippines or whatever.
Yeah, so often they get to that threshold and they start looking at offshoring or firing Australians.
Yeah.
That's what they do.
Yeah.
Because of this stupidity.
And the regulations, six different, you know, thresholds, six different rates, and where do you work? If you're running a national business and you've got a manager and working out of five different states,
your company's large and small, falling foul of the complexity. Like
yeah,
Coles and Woolies, you know, when they short play employees, in my mind, they might do a lot of things, but I don't think they have a board meeting in Sydney going, let's figure out a way to screw all our employees. It's just such a complex system that even the biggest, what do you think of that? Do you think that there's that kind of underhandedness happening?
Not with payroll tax.
No.
They do it with offshoring profits.
Right.
That's another thing. It's too hard to play games. Yeah, you've got to have a shop in Brisbane to sell groceries, right? So, yeah.
I want to have a chat about a policy, and a lot of the viewers here are in property and entrepreneurship businesses.
Yeah.
And you've got a policy, which I found quite interesting, but I want to learn a little bit about it myself. And it's to remove the CGT, so capital gains tax discount, and instead index the cost of the cost base of assets. So can you explain that? Because a lot of people here will own properties. A lot of people here will own businesses.
Sure.
And when, you know, that's a big thing for all of us, right? Going, oh, we just sold a business and we get 50% capital gains tax exemption. Yes, right? Is it better for us or is it worse for us?
It'll depend. The longer you hold, the better it'll be. So we're going to average capital gains over the period of the time you held it. So if you hold now for over 12 months and you made 400 grand profit,
yep,
you'd pay tax on 200, right? Or yep, what you'd do is you'd pay you made 400 grand profit, you'd be up in the high tax, say 45 cent bracket,
yep,
you'd pay 23.5 cents.
Yep.
What I'm proposing is that if you held it for 10 years, you would pay divided by 10 and you'd pay the average rate on $40,000 a year. So under my policy, if you got the $40,000 tax free, you'd pay nothing, right? But if, let's say it was a million and it was $100,000 a year, so the tax on $100,000 is just under $25,000. So let's say 25 cents in the dollar on $100,000, you'd pay 25 cents on the million. Because what I don't like about the 50% CGT discount is it's a blunt instrument, right? So it doesn't take into account the longevity you held an asset. And you get indexation on that as well, right? Whereas the 50% CGT, you can hold it for 12 months, make $1 million and pay half the rate of tax, the same rate of tax if you held something for 20 years. And I don't think that's right. I think we want to encourage people to hold longer because once there's a lot of speculators who hold 12. What they do is actually on the stock market, they make a killing. They will actually move offshore to become a non-resident, cash out, and then they pay no tax because they don't have to under the capital. So there's a section in the Tax Act that says if you're own less than 10% of shares in a company, so a non-portfolio interest, you don't have to pay capital gains tax if you're a foreigner. So people will move overseas, cash out their lump sum gain, and then come back home again. So I'd get rid of that tax as well.
So basically, in the big scheme of things, the longer you hold the asset, the better off you will be.
Yeah.
But if you're in for a quick win, if you hold something for 1 or 2 years, you'll be worse off.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I want to incentivize long-term holding assets and being productive rather than speculating.
Yeah.
The other thing
and just flipping assets.
The other policy you have that I think will resonate with a lot of Aussies is banning foreign ownership of key assets.
Yeah.
I think, especially given where we are in the world, we're pretty isolated down here.
Yeah.
And we're seeing ports and different things being sold off, huge tracts of farmland being sold off. How would that work? And is there a way to, if someone like you was prime minister, could you retrospectively buy back these assets?
We can make an offer. I wouldn't seize the assets. I mean, I'd let the people, you know, eventually. So a lot of these ports and that are currently on leases. So we could buy the lease out or just let the lease lapse. So a lot of these, some of these leases are 50-year leases and they're already 15, 20 years into it. But that is the point of the infrastructure bank as well, is that we could start buying back assets. And we would have to do that if we were to make superannuation voluntary. There's going to be a problem with superannuation. This is another issue on superannuation. I'd expect around 2040. So superannuation came in 1992. So after about 48 years, an entire generation when people start to retire, withdrawals are going to start to exceed contributions. So that means money going out is going to start to exceed money going in. So money going in has inflated these industrial assets. As the money starts to go out, it's going to start super funds are going to have to start liquidating these big infrastructure assets. It won't happen as, you know, suddenly, but it will happen. So you're going to need the government to step back in again and start buying this. That's where we need that infrastructure bank and the profits from that infrastructure bank to start buying it back.
But you want to ban foreign ownership of what are those key assets that will fall under that?
Infrastructure,
policy?
Housing, and agricultural land.
So they can't buy houses, foreigners.
They can't buy houses. They can buy units. If you want to buy a unit, that's fine. But you can't buy houses and land. So only the unit, but not the land.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And farmland, no farmland.
No farmland.
All Aussie owned.
all Aussie owned.
I don't think people understand how much agriculture has been sold off. I was at a private equity luncheon a couple of weeks ago, and one of the speakers was a very successful family business, and they sold off a massive macadamia business. They owned one of the biggest macadamia farms, and somebody asked who bought it, and it was a foreign company. And then she went on to say that that same company owns 70% now of the whole nuts business in all of Australia. 70% controlled by one foreign company that obviously is probably not paying much tax.
Yeah, that'd be shit. Well, here's the thing. There's another section in the Tax Act, actually similar to the one, so it's 855 of the 1997 Act, called the Non-Portfolio Interest Test, that water rights have been deemed a non-real asset. So that means if a foreigner buys irrigation water rights in this country, they shouldn't be allowed to do it at all. They make a capital gain on it. They don't have to pay capital gains tax. So number one, we shouldn't let them buy it. But not only do we not let them buy it, we then say you don't have to pay tax on it. So how are our farmers who are trying to buy water...
Who's running this place?
Yeah, but we're controlling the number one asset is water, because without water, it doesn't matter how much gold you have, doesn't matter how much Bitcoin you have, how much property you have, you're finished.
Yeah. And yet again, I have raised this issue. I have tried to get it up in the party room, got nowhere. This is one of the reasons I went out on my own, because I wanted to get this stuff out here.
Yeah.
Because it's great. Yeah, weeping tears of blood.
We've got a little bit time left, not much. I know you've got to go to another meeting, and we appreciate the time you're giving us. I've got two big ones here. I don't know which one to go to. One, I know that you want to have a parliamentary inquiry into the mismanagement of COVID and that whole shit show. And also the other big one is, I love it when you talk about thermodynamics and the climate scam. Which of those would you like to tackle?
I'll tackle both. I mean, the first one is self-evident. Now, the inquiry into COVID, look, I don't care how they do it. You know, everyone says, let's have a royal commission into it. You can have a royal commission, but it doesn't mean to say people are going to go to jail. People need to be held to account. How you get to that end, I don't care, but people need to be held to account, step one. And step two, these mRNA vaccines are not safe. A traditional vaccine, okay, so you got to understand, I'll touch on this very briefly, right? Pathogens, you've got three types of pathogens: bacteria, double-stranded DNA, single-stranded mRNA, right? So your bacteria doesn't mutate. A lot of your vaccines are bacteria-based, right? That means if you get, and they're blood-borne. And then you've got two immune systems. You've got your mucosal system, right, which is your snot and things like that. And then you've got your systemic system, which is in your blood. Your blood's controlled by IgG, immunoglobulin G, and your mucosal system's controlled by immunoglobulin A. For viral respiratory transmission, if you put something in your arm, you are only going to get an IgG response in your blood. You are not going to get a mucosal response. So vaccines do not work for respiratory diseases. They only work for blood-borne diseases if you put you there. If you put a nasal spray up your nose, and then that can create, you know, an IgA response. Right, so keeping all that in mind, the mRNA vaccine is different to a normal protein vaccine, right? COVID had 29 proteins. Normally, if you had a protein vaccine for that virus, you would pull off the spike protein and you'd get the other 28 proteins. That is a big, it's like 28 people walking through that door over there. It can't travel around your body. It can't cross the endothelium in your bloodstream and travel throughout your body. What they did with the mRNA vaccine is they took the spike protein, they got the mRNA for the spike protein and stuck it inside a lipid. And that's hence the word nanoparticle. Nanoparticle means 1 to 10 to the power of -9, right? As opposed to a normal size particle, which is a millionth or a micron, which is 1 to 10 to the power of -6. So imagine 1,000 of you there, Adam. That's a much bigger object than one of you, right? That means, so this mRNA vaccine, because it's a nanoparticle, could travel throughout your body. Step one, right? Step two, it uses transfection. So those lipids were slightly polarized. I won't go into too much detail. But what that meant is it could cross the cell membrane of any cell. So the virus could only cross the membrane of a cell with an ACE receptor, an antigen-converting enzyme. Not all organs in your body have cells with ACE receptors, in particular your spleen, which produces white blood cells. Now, this is very, very important, because if that vaccine could cross in and the mRNA inside that vaccine could travel throughout your body and cross any cell membrane, it can go into any cell, right? Step two. Step three, you're now inducing, because it's gone inside your cells, a T-cell response. So if you go back to your initial protein vaccine, 28 proteins, big macromolecule, it can't travel across your body. It stays up in your arm and stays close to your lymph nodes up in your arm. Your immune system recognizes it as a foreign agent, sends the B cells to kill the foreign agent, right? Go back to the mRNA vaccine, it's now attacked inside your cells. Your immune system won't use B cells, it'll use T cells, killer cells, to go in there and kill your own otherwise healthy cells. So it's kind of like chemotherapy vaccine style, except it goes across any organ, right? So these mRNA vaccines cannot target the actual cells that carry the virus, right? Now, remember that also single-stranded mRNA virus mutates very easily. Bacteria won't mutate, it doesn't mutate, and you have double-stranded DNA. So when Edward Jenner created the vaccine, that was for smallpox, that's a double-stranded DNA. So you know your Crick Watson model here, you've got the little hydrogen bonds that hold the two ladders together?
No, but I'm going to say yes.
Yeah, so so you'll see it. It's the famous DNA helix model.
Oh, yes, okay.
Yeah. So like, it's like a ladder, and you've got the little steps, you know, yep, the thing. Yep. So the hydrogen bonds hold it in place, so very hard to mutate. Single-stranded mRNA mutates very easily. So there's no point vaccinating against a single mRNA strand because it will mutate faster and you'll create this thing called immune imprinting that the next time, as it mutates, the next virus you get, your immune system will react slower. So mRNA vaccines will induce an autoimmune response that damages your body, hence myocarditis and all these adverse.
So it's super dangerous.
Super dangerous. I mean, a lot of the stuff broke up, mRNA broke up. So a lot of people got a dose, but it wasn't even... You know, the mRNA had already broke up. But if you manage to get one that has still intact and it goes to the wrong parts of your body, it's a bit of a lottery. It's like Russian roulette. It is super dangerous. So number one, it's not safe. And number two, it's not effective anyway because you're not going to stop transmission. So that's the big key thing there. So the thermodynamics.
I mean, that when you think about the cost and the impact and the borrowing of our future children's wealth with all the money that was created and like the impact of that on the Australian people, the psychology of our kids being locked at home, the financial impact, which is still into the future, it's enormous. And there's been no apologies. There's been nobody held to account. There's been almost nothing. It's just like it never happened. And the people who oversaw it just sailed off into the sunset with their government. This is why so many Australians are pissed off.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to add my two cents on the end there. And I would love for that to happen myself. And if you're a listener here, drop a comment below, because I think there's one question. If any of these other guys come in, I'm going to ask them, do you think you owe the Australian people an apology? You know, because yeah. I think they do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Based on the fact that I think I did a quick poll on my Instagram and I said, only answer this if you got vaccinated. Do you regret it? And it was like 90% of people who got it regretted. Obviously, everybody else who didn't get it obviously don't agree with it. So most of the country, I think, is pissed off about this.
Yeah.
So thank you for answering.
And what's worse is that COVID itself is engineered in the Wuhan laboratory. Yeah, and I mean, that's a whole rabbit, another rabbit hole we could go down to. But Fauci in January 2017 said at Georgetown University, the day before Trump was inaugurated on his first term, that there will be a surprise infectious disease outbreak in the term of Trump's presidency.
Mm.
Now, had there been a bunch of Mozzies coming from Mexico, yep, fair enough, you could see that there was a pathogen out there. But who predicts a surprise infectious disease outbreak in relation to a political term? Mm. Very, very strange.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, of course, a bat flying over a pig farm or some bullshit.
Yeah, pangolin. Yeah, pangolin, a raccoon dog. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so moving on from that, let's finish off with the climate scam. Explain to us, in as like, I know for you this probably is simple, but in as simple language, because all of us trees is way above our pay grade.
I just had a science lesson. So,
simple as you can, like how the I heard you speak about this in another pod where you talked about thermodynamics and why, here's the science of it. You talked about a ute hitting another ute and all this stuff. Plain English, Aussie.
Okay. It's we could break this down a number of ways. So I'll start with the very simple stuff.
Yeah.
First of all, I've asked for the net zero stuff. So this isn't the science. This is the way we're going to measure net zero. I've asked the CSIRO on the model for the model they're going to calculate net zero. And the answer I got was, which one? And I said, what do you mean, which one? And the reply was, well, there's 40 different models to calculate net zero. So first of all, if there's 40 different models to calculate net zero, clearly the science isn't settled. Number two, I've asked the CSIRO, do you include phytoplankton in your models? And the answer was no. The reason why I asked that question is phytoplankton absorbs about 30-40% of the world's CO2 in the oceans. Wow. The models only are based on land-based usage, and they ignore that there's a thing called convection in the atmosphere, i.e. the wind, what we know as the wind, that blows a lot of the CO2 offshore into the ocean where it's sucked up by the phytoplankton. And the phytoplankton responds to CO2, i.e. it expands, you know, you get more of it, just like green grass grows faster after it rains. So we have natural stabilizers in the planet already to deal with an increase in CO2.
So the more of it absorbs the plankton, the more of it is made and produced. Is that what
you're saying? Well, no, phytoplankton absorbs CO2.
Yes, but does the phytoplankton expand as a result of absorbing it?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying? Yes. Yeah, so the more that's coming, it's expanding as well.
Yeah, exactly. And phytoplankton's whale food, right? So, you know, it's actually good for the whales.
Win-win.
Win-win. Now, the science of it is one of the term itself, greenhouse gas effect, is a complete and utter misnomer. There's this idea they've used the term that there's, you know, a greenhouse gas traps convection. It stops, a greenhouse is a solid and it stops hot air from rising, right? So to compare a gas, which is what CO2 is, to a solid, first of all, is a big fail, right? Like anyone that says, you know, CO2 acts like a greenhouse is comparing gas to a solid, you don't know what you're talking about, step one. Step two, hot air rises, okay? So this idea that hot air gets trapped is not true. If you look at a hot air balloon, you put hot air in it, what happens? It rises up in the atmosphere, you boil the jug, the steam rises to the top, right? What traps heat, and it's, I don't like using that term, and I'll explain why in a minute, in the atmosphere, is gravity, right? And this goes, so where do I go from there? So what heat is or temperature is a measure of mean molecular momentum. So what we're trapping, gravity, what creates heat in the atmosphere is the molecules and heat. Now, heat is kinetic energy, the energy of motion, and we know that heat is directly, energy is directly related to mass. That's Einstein's special theory of relativity from 1905, E equals mc squared. Energy is mass times the motion of that mass. Okay, now Einstein came up with a general theory of relativity, which introduced gravity into the theory, and that was necessary because all bodies are accelerating as a result of gravity. Gravity is the force that keeps us on planet Earth. When you throw a ball up into the air and that ball comes back down to Earth, it's not the actual radiation from the CO2 that's pushing the ball down, it's gravity. And that is what, it's actually the gravitational effect that gives us heat in the atmosphere. It traps the molecules and the molecules collide with everyone else. Now, if I was to lodge my tax return and say my income had changed, the tax office would come back to me and say, that's not good enough. You have to be specific, right? Yet the government wants us to pay billions of dollars in taxes to pay subsidies to deal with climate change. If you're going to charge that, you need to be very specific about what we get in return for spending that money. All science is based on mathematics. The reason why Einstein's famous is because he came up with that, well, he came up quite a number of theories, but one of them was E equals mc squared. He then came up with his theory of general relativity. The most famous scientist before before Albert Einstein was Isaac Newton. In 1687, he came up with the universal theory of gravitation. He didn't just, you know, as we're taught at school, see an apple fall from the tree and go, that's gravity. He actually came up with a formula for gravity, which was the product of the masses of the two objects, and that was over the square of the distance between them. This law, this universal law of gravitation, was used in the early 19th century, the 1800s, by astronomers who couldn't understand using the universal law of gravitation why the planets traveled in the orbit they did. They knew that there must have been another planet out there. That's how they discovered Pluto. Gravity is very hard to conceptualize at the small level, but on the planetary level, that's, you know, it actually works. I mean, it still works here, but we just see it as something more denser than something else, right? And that comes back to the mass. Okay, but the reason why that matters is that when you want to know the impact of CO2 on the atmosphere, it comes back to the mass. So it is true that increasing CO2 in the atmosphere to the extent you're increasing mass in the atmosphere will actually increase the temperature. And we know that because CO2 is a gas And you ask yourself, well, all science is based on mathematics. Is there an algorithm between gas and temperature? Yes, there is. It's called the ideal gas law, PV equals NRT. P for pressure, V for volume, N for the number of molecules. Let's assume that's steady. R is a constant and T is temperature, i.e. energy. So if we strip out the, so let's do the sums here. Pressure is force over volume. So that is, take out your two volumes, you're left with force. Force, second law of Newton's law of motions is mass times acceleration. So we now got mass times acceleration equals temperature, i.e. energy. Take the A out and you'll recognize mass equals energy. That goes back to Einstein's 1905 theory, right? Add the A back in and you get the general theory of relativity from 1915. But here's the key thing. That A represents what?
Gravity.
Gravity, right? So it's gravity that drives heat in the atmosphere. Now, you can throw, you can increase. So temperature is a measure of mean molecular momentum. So that's how fast all the molecules are moving in the atmosphere. And the faster they move, the hotter it is. Heat is the combined volume of that system. So there's more heat in the ocean than there is in a boiling jug, but the temperature of the boiling jug is much hotter, right? So look at heat as being the entire volume of a system contained amongst all those molecules, right? So what happens is when radiation hits that that pool of energy, so gravity, you know, when you've got a magnet and you've got two magnets together, they can pull each other, right? You know, if you've got a bathtub and you start putting water and eventually it fills up and then starts to spill over, gravity can only hold so much energy in based on, so the Earth can obviously hold a, you know, very big atmosphere, but if you add too much heat, heat works against gravity, right? So when radiation comes in and heats something up, other molecules will be heated and they'll escape, yeah, it's escape velocity of about 11 meters per second and yeah, up high enough and you'll escape the Earth's gravity, right? So yes, radiation added to the atmosphere every day will increase the temperature of the Earth, but the gravitational pull of the atmosphere will only can only hold so much, right? Now, the other thing is, so as that temperature is increased here, so just like you throw a rock into a lake, you'll get waves, right? Eventually, that will settle back down again. That is gravity working. You can't have convection without gravity. So gravity is what drives convection and conduction. And the whole idea, so if we go back to what these guys want you to believe, so we can disprove it another way, the climate alarmists want you to believe if you add 100 parts per million of CO2 to the atmosphere, that's one part per 10,000. They want you to believe that one part per 10,000 of CO2 can heat up the other 10,000 molecules by 1 degree. Now, under the first law of thermodynamics, right, so energy is neither created or destroyed, it's just transformed or transferred, right? You can't get something out of nothing. So in order for that one molecule to heat up 10,000 other molecules by 1 degree, I'm ignoring specific densities here, just ignore that for the time being. It's got to be 10,000 degrees Celsius. That cannot happen under the first law of thermodynamics, which is that energy is it's called the energy conservation. So you can't even, their theory, you can just disprove, forget about all the stuff about gravity. You can just use the first law of thermodynamics to disprove that you can't get energy out of something. They're trying to argue that basically one molecule can heat up 10,000 other molecules by 1 degree. That's complete ridiculous. That's ridiculous because the CO2 molecule would have to be 10,000 degrees Celsius, which it can't be.
So if we just went ahead and we just like ignore and forgot the greenies and gagged them all up and then just developed the world and pulled people out of poverty, what would be the actual increase, in your opinion, of our global temperature?
Okay, so we can work out. So this is
using math.
Yeah, using math. So PV equals NRT. So for every 100 parts per million, that's one part per 10,000. The temperature of the atmosphere is 287 degrees Kelvin, or 15 degrees Celsius plus the 272 for Kelvin. The ideal gas law is expressed in Kelvin. So you go 1 over 10,000 times 272, which is 0.027 of a degree, not 0.27, 0.027. You times it by the specific density of carbon dioxide. So carbon dioxide's got what, one carbon molecule at 6, which has 6 protons, and 2 oxide at an oxygen molecule is 8 protons. So 8 plus 8 plus 6 is 22. The average density of the atmosphere is about 13.8. That's because you've got what, 80% nitrogen and 20% oxygen. So nitrogen's 7 plus 7, 14. N2O2 is 6 plus 6. No, 8 plus 8, sorry, which is 16. Yeah, so 23 over, about 23 for carbon dioxide over 14 what is it, 60%, 80% nitrogen. So yeah, 14. So sorry, the specific density must be 14.2, sorry. So it's about 1.5. So you just go 1.5. So i.e. carbon dioxide is about 1.5 heavier times heavier than N2 and O2 combined in weighted average, which is the bulk of the atmosphere, times 0.027 is about 0.43, I think, off the top of my head. So basically, for every 100 parts per million of CO2, assuming that it's not sucked up by plankton, phytoplankton, which most of it is, you'll increase the atmosphere of the planet by 0.04 of a degree. So
0.04 of 1 degree.
Yeah, yeah. Which, you know, for the price of bringing 6 billion people out of poverty, I'd argue is worth it. But it's virtually negligible.
So we should be out of the Paris Climate Change Accord and all that.
Yeah, absolutely. And but it's important to emphasise, just because you don't believe in climate change doesn't mean to say you don't care about the environment.
No, of course.
And there's three separate issues here. One is, right, do we care about the environment? Absolutely. Of course we do, right? We do care about the environment. Do we believe in climate change? Yeah, we believe in climate change because the climate changes every day. But do we believe that you should spend money on something that you can't quantify? Absolutely not, right? So that's the other issue. And the question is, how do we deal with living in the world we do today and protect our beautiful, you know, nature, our biodiversity and our environment? And I can assure you, renewables on an industrial scale is not the way to do it. And that's the issue. I think, you know, the small little, you know, you do get some nitrogen oxide and sulfur dioxide out of carbon, out of coal-powered fire stations. A lot of that is scrubbed out and collected so it doesn't go anywhere. But carbon dioxide, the most renewable form of energy on Earth, is the process of photosynthesis, one of which three ingredients is carbon dioxide, the other two being O2 and H2O, water, oxygen, and carbon dioxide. To somehow think that carbon dioxide is a pollutant is completely rubbish. It is the source of life. Without carbon dioxide, the plants can't breathe, phytoplankton can't breathe, we won't have whales, and, you know, we won't have trees. So this whole idea of demonising carbon dioxide is a complete and utter myth. Yeah, just absurd.
All these greenies, you are killing whales. You are killing whales when
you're starving them, of phytoplankton. And this is the ridiculous thing. Many of your listeners can understand, forget the science, but you know that renewables, it's not good for the environment, but we're actually, you know, importing these renewables.
Yeah.
These renewables are owned by foreign companies and they're replacing our own homegrown resources and, you know, what was once government-owned. I mean, a lot of these, you know, government-owned power stations, we've kept our coal-powered fire stations up here in Queensland only just, but in other states they were privatised. They were then bought out by private companies who shut them down and then started becoming rent seekers for renewable energy. That type of madness, we did that with capital controls in 1985. We're doing it with immigration. This is where our governments are going wrong. They've got everything back to front, where they're serving the interests of foreign people, you know, foreigners in front of Australians. And look, you know, as I said before, I spent 7 years traveling around the world, went to 85 countries. I still believe there's one race, the human race. But when it comes to governing, your responsibility is the people that elect you, not the people that don't elect you.
I think that's a great place to end it today. That is.
Eric's got a test coming up for 20 questions after this, mate. If you fail, that G-Wagon's mine, which will blast a bit more CO2.
I actually can now say, you know, sometimes in the park, I go, like, I'm somewhat intelligent. I can't say that anymore.
It would be lovely, Gerard, to see somebody in power who's actually really smart, and not to blow smoke up your ass, but we really do need that kind of level of intellect. And it's just so refreshing, and we really appreciate you coming in. And I've watched you at Senate Estimates, you know, and the little, you know, videos, and I just want to encourage you and the people that you're working with to keep doing what you're doing, holding their feet to the fire. We need people with high IQs and that are prepared to be one of the things. I think being an Australian politician is one of the hardest gigs in the world, like, because we've, you know, a very unique culture here where we crucify our pollies. And it's a pretty thankless job, I'm sure, at times.
I actually get a lot of thanks from the constituents. So thanks to all your listeners that do support me. I really appreciate it. Look, the criticism of politicians is actually justified. No, I'm serious because, no, they are weak and insipid. I mean, I don't get, fair enough, not every one of them's a rocket scientist, but what I dislike about the people in the major parties, and some of them are my former colleagues who are still friends of mine, that the amount of self-loathing that goes on within the Liberal Party from colleagues, yeah, they still call me, I mean, they're still friends of mine, right? And they whinge and they moan and they hate themselves because they know they're not fighting the fight and they're gagged. And, you know, I was listening to the old classic 10 to 1 by Midnight Oil this morning on the way down with Power and the Passion, where it says better to die on your feet than to live on your knees. Some of these politicians need to actually start being prepared to die on their feet politically so that our children don't have to live on their knees, because we are suffering because not only do they not have the vision, you know, to and the solutions to get Australia out of the mess we're in, they don't have the courage to even fight. And I think they go hand in hand. If you know what the solutions are and you know what you believe in and you know that this, you know, what you're doing is right, you'll have the courage. But one of the reasons why a lot of these people don't have the courage is they're gagged. They're not actually doing what they really should be doing, which is fighting the fight. They're sitting there being told to shut up, and they shut up because they're afraid of losing their job.
Senator Gerard Rennick, thank you so much. If you want to get all the policies, guys, unemployable.com.au/Rennick, R-E-N-N-I-C-K. If you want them in a concise format, or if you want to go directly to his website, it is gerardrennick.com.au, and social media as well. Pretty easy to find you, I'm sure.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, Senator Gerard Rennick. Yeah.
Senator Gerard Rennick. So, guys, I hope you've enjoyed it. Please drop a comment. Let us know. Do you want more guests like this? What did you learn today? You know, engage in debate, because the more you engage with this video, the more it will be promoted by the algorithm. I don't know how we're going to go with all the COVID stuff in it. Maybe we're going to get misinformation warnings all over it. But the more you engage and do those little things, it just helps grow the number of views and the number of the level of engagement, and enables us to get more people like this on the pod, because the attention is here. And that is how the platforms and the algorithms work. So thank you so much for your support, guys. And we'll see you soon. Remember, the vote. That's the thing. Vote. Put them at the top of the card, the person you want. Cheers.
Hey there. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.